Okay, so it's a pleasure to have Fiona Bernal give a talk at our seminar. So Fiona got her PhD at Princeton and then did a postdoc at Oxford, I believe. And so in 2013, she became a professor at University of Minnesota, and she stayed there ever since. So Fiona has done a lot of very well-known work, but particularly in the field of symmetry-protected topological phases. And so today she's going to tell us about some recent developments in that area. So Fiona, you can start.
Oops, sorry. Okay, I just advanced the slides. Hey, great. So yeah, thanks for listening. And obviously, feel free to interrupt with questions at any point in the talk. Lively discussion is always fun. So all right, so let me start by kind of reminding you of the underlying question here. So, we in condensed matter have historically been very interested in the question of how do we distinguish between different phases of matter, right? So, you know, maybe the same system in different regimes has qualitatively different properties. And so the sort of 20th century picture of how we do this is called the Landau paradigm due to Lev Landau. And, you know, the idea is, well, often you have systems where, as a function of some parameter, maybe temperature, you see a spontaneous breaking of symmetry leading to a phase transition. So a classic example of that would be a ferromagnet. So, you know, at high temperature, here's the cartoon. Each arrow represents a little magnetic moment, and these magnetic moments, you know, entropy favors them being randomly oriented. So at high temperature, entropy wins, and we see that they're all kind of just doing their own thing. But at low temperature, the energy will start to dominate, and perhaps energetically, they all want to line up in a particular direction, and that forces them to pick a direction for the system's net magnetic moment, and that choice of direction breaks the rotational symmetry. Okay, and so in the Landau paradigm, you know, different phases of matter correspond to different, you know, basically different symmetry groups, because the symmetry becomes reduced due to spontaneous symmetry breaking, across these phase transitions. Okay, now why is this happening? Okay, here we go. Starting in the 21st century, we began to understand that there are other ways in which global symmetry can give you distinct phases of matter. So this is what we call symmetry protected topological phases of matter, for reasons that I'll get into in a minute. But the basic story is that I can have two phases with the same unbroken symmetry that, you know, locally in the bulk look completely the same. So I look locally at these magnetic moments and they're disordered, you know, here, and okay, could be high temperature, low temperature, or some parameter that you're tuning, okay, to compare different systems. And, you know, here I look locally and they also look disordered. So the local properties look the same, but nevertheless, we know that there are distinct phases of matter. And so I wanted to begin by giving you just a brief kind of overview of how these ideas developed in condensed matter physics. So prior to 2004, there were a couple of examples known, but they were sort of enigmatic. Okay, so there were, you know, famously the Haldane phase of the spin one chain was a phase that was known not to break the SO3 spin rotation symmetry, but was nonetheless a distinct phase of matter. But it wasn't until 2004 with the paper by Kane and Millay about 2D topological insulators that people began to understand that this was not a sort of strange feature of a few examples, but that actually it's a very general phenomenon that you can think about generally, you can identify general principles which allow you to distinguish between two phases which have the same unbroken global symmetry and in the bulk look, you know, locally identical, but nevertheless are distinct. And this sort of understanding began with topological insulators, topological band insulators, which is to say non-interacting systems of electrons. And in starting in around 2009 and driven primarily by Chen Gu, Liu, and Wen, a series of their papers, although there were many, many groups that made seminal contributions to these developments, people realized that, you know, how to apply that philosophy to interacting phases of matter, okay? So I'm gonna start by kind of reviewing these developments here. And then what I'd like to tell you about is a more recent set of ideas. So I'm going to focus on subsystem symmetry protected topological phases. So I'll get to what that is. But I'd also like to sort of argue that these are in some sense related or helpful for thinking about a new kind of topological band insulator introduced by Benalcazar, Hughes, and Brnovich called higher order topological band insulators, which are distinct from ordinary topological band insulators by the nature of the modes that live at their boundaries. So I should say, you know, as I'm sure you all know, topological insulators are famous for having protected gapless boundary modes. So higher order topological insulators have protected gapless modes, not everywhere on their boundary, but at the boundary of a boundary, which is to say, if you have a square lattice, you know, you can have a protected boundary mode at a corner. Okay, so this is where I'd like to get to, but we're going to start up here just to make sure we're all on the same page. So, so as I said, you know, people first understood these general principles about symmetry protected phases of matter by thinking about systems of free fermions. Now, for free fermions, you have a tremendous advantage in understanding the system, which is to say that the crystal momentum of each electron is separately conserved, and so you can write down a band structure. Okay, and the basic observation, without getting into detail, is that there are topological invariants of these band structures, even in the presence of time reversal symmetry. There are topological invariants of these band structures, which allowed you to understand what's going on in these topological insulators. And so here's a cartoon, very much a cartoon of, you know, what a topological invariant of a band structure means. But, you know, basically you have an eigenstate at each momentum k. Okay, now momentum is periodic on the Brillouin zone, and so, you know, the phase of this eigenfunction could twist or not as you go around the Brillouin zone, and so you can sort of imagine those topologically distinct classes. Okay, and of course, this is a lovely way of thinking about these systems of free fermions and allowed us to understand many, many examples. And it's also very, very powerful if you want to actually predict what kinds of materials may be topological insulators. Because once we understand the properties that we're looking for in a band structure, materials scientists are very good at identifying, you know, band structures, materials that may have those band structures. Okay. But there was another way of thinking about this, which was, I think Joel Moore was a big advocate of this philosophy very early on, which is, well, what's special about these topological insulators is, well, first of all, that they have symmetry protected gapless boundary modes. Okay, so let me just, you know, here's a cartoon of a 2D topological insulator. We have a bulk gap, okay, and then we have these lines here represent states that are localized to the boundary, okay. And the key observation is that if I have time reversal symmetry, there's some crossing here that cannot be lifted. If it's lifted, you can show that time reversal symmetry must be broken, okay. This is what's called Cronin's degeneracy. But moreover, you know, you might say to yourself, "Eh, all I have to do is just add another copy of this edge, okay? And if you had two copies of this edge, you can show that there's backscattering processes that respect time reversal symmetry that are allowed, okay? So you might think this is not so special, but what you can show, in fact, is that as a purely one-dimensional system that you could kind of just stick onto your boundary to get rid of this, you can't actually make a one-dimensional system that has time reversal, that has a single copy of this edge. You always have to have two copies, okay? And so this was like, you know, a very, I think, useful way of thinking about these gapless boundaries, which is that there's some kind of anomaly associated with the stuff that lives at the boundary of these topological insulators, such that that boundary can't exist by itself with the same symmetry in a lower dimension, okay? And, you know, amusingly, if you sort of think about three-dimensional topological insulators, for example, these anomalies are, you know, related to anomalies that had been studied in field theories a long time before. Okay, and so it's the second way of thinking about these systems, talking about, you know, focusing on the gapless boundaries and understanding that their gaplessness is guaranteed by some kind of anomaly to do with the global symmetry, meaning that you know, that edge theory, that boundary theory cannot exist in a lower dimension. it's this intuition that really allowed people to generalize these ideas to strongly interacting systems. Okay. And so what I'd like to do is quickly review how this works. I'm going to start in one dimension and then show you how it applies to subsystem symmetric topological phases. Okay. So let me begin with the sort of simplest example of a strongly interacting topological phase, and the one that's been, sort of floating around for many decades, which is the Haldane phase of the spin one chain. And the easiest way to understand the Haldane phase of the spin one chain is to look at the AKLT, so Affleck, Kennedy, Lieben, Takahashi chain, which is a particular Hamiltonian that lives in this phase. Okay. So the game that we're playing is we're thinking about a spin one chain. Okay. So spin one on each site of our system. Okay. And we're going to write down this Hamiltonian here. It clearly has SO3 spin rotation invariance. And this is the AKLT Hamiltonian. Okay. So it's just got a Heisenberg term and then SI.SI+1² term. And you might, wonder why add this second piece. And the answer is because that turns this Hamiltonian into a sum of projectors where basically at each pair of sites, J and J plus one, you're going to energetically penalize the spin two, the net spin two representation. Okay, so all states where sites J and J plus one combine to give a net spin two, those configurations can't be in the ground state. Okay, and this actually allows you to draw a nice simple cartoon representation of the ground state in the following way. So we can actually break our spin one on each site into a pair of spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. And provided that you project back onto the physical Hilbert space, which has only three of the four possible states of 2 spins 1/2, right? The three triplet states, this is absolutely fine. It's an exact representation of your Hilbert space. But now you can draw this nice cartoon picture where you take a spin 1/2 from this site here and you put it in a singlet bond. So here's my singlet bond with a spin 1/2 from a neighboring site. Okay. And then, you can see that if you have these singlet bonds and I look at a pair of sites, right? If these two spin 1/2s are in a net spin zero, then I'm not going to have any total spin two coming out of this picture. Okay. And so that's the ground state of the AKLT model. And then in this cartoon, we observe that there is this free spin 1/2 at the end of the chain, right? That isn't singlet bonded to anyone. And so in fact, you can show that this is not some weird feature of your cartoon, but actually if you look in detail at the way that certain symmetries act on this chain, you will see that they actually really do act in a way that sort of looks, that seems to know, if you will, locally that there's a spin 1/2 that's sort of living here on this boundary. Okay. And so this way of thinking can be sort of formalized in a way that can be generalized just by asking, well, what is it that's sort of anomalous? If we want to kind of make this connection to topological insulators, what's anomalous about having spin 1/2 at the end of a spin one chain? Okay. And the technical word for this is that, remember, the underlying symmetry, it's a spin one chain. Okay. The underlying symmetry should act like SO3, right? And so spin 1/2 is not a representation of SO3, but it's off only by some minus signs. Okay. So, famously in undergrad quantum mechanics, we learn you take a fermion and you rotate it by 2 pi and you get -1, right? So it doesn't live in a representation of rotations, SO3, but it's very close. You just get some extra minus signs, okay? And it turns out, and this will be important for us in a few minutes, it turns out that the most important minus sign, okay, comes from the fact that, for example, if you look at rotations by pi, okay, about the x and y axes, so these act as sigma x and sigma y on your spin 1/2, the fact that these generators don't commute with each other gives you a minus sign that you can't get rid of just by saying, well, maybe somehow the way that I wrote my symmetry generator here was off by a phase, okay? that really there are some minus signs that are fundamental and that they come from the fact that these symmetry generators don't commute. Okay. And so the word for this is that spin a half is in what we call a projective representation of SO3. That's what we call it when we have these extra phases. And the significant, okay, and then you can ask, well, you know, what does that imply for the endpoints of the system being sort of anomalous? And the answer to that question is that if I took, you know, extra sites in my Hilbert space, right, which is to say I'm going to have an integer spin on each of these extra sites, and I start sticking them to my boundary, I can never cancel this odd number of spin a halves, okay? You know, anytime your on-site Hilbert space is in a linear representation of the symmetry, you can never get rid of the fact that, you know, you have this projective representation floating around here. So that's the sense in which it's anomalous. And so this led to a classification, which is, you know, for these 1D phases, the number for a given symmetry group G, the number of distinct phases that you can have, which are, you know, distinguished by these different projective representations of their boundaries, is given by the second group cohomology of G with U1 coefficients, okay? And very good. Okay. And so, right, and I should say also that I realize there's a couple of other works. These are the two works that kind of focused on this AKLT-like chain, but there's also work by Vitkowski and Kataev, as well as by Norbert Shu on, you know, very kind of similar concepts that I probably should have acknowledged here. Okay, great. So, so that's how this works in one dimension. And so now I want to sort of run with this one-dimensional thing, and I want to tell you a little bit about subsystem symmetries on one-dimensional subsystems in two-dimensional systems, and how they're related to our understanding of 1D interacting SPT phases. Okay, so let me begin by telling you what is subsystem symmetry, okay? So before, when I said symmetry, it was understood that I was talking about global symmetries, meaning they act on all degrees of freedom in the, you know, in the system at once, right? So, you know, S dot S is invariant if I rotate all the spins at once, but obviously not if I rotate, you know, one by itself. Now, I'm sure you're all also familiar with gauge symmetries, which we think of as being the ability to kind of locally rotate things at a given site. And so subsystem symmetry is something that's intermediate between these two, where I'm going to pick some kind of subsystem, and I'm going to act with the symmetry on all of the sites in the subsystem. So the example that I want to focus on for the next little while is the example where my subsystems are lines, okay? And I'm going to act with a symmetry on all of the sites in a line. And I'm going to have lines. I'm going to work on a square lattice. I'm going to have lines in the x and y directions, okay? Although you know, you can also have different kinds of subsystems, such as maybe planes in three dimensions or even fractals. Now, an important thing to realize about subsystem symmetry is, I think, best understood if we imagine that the symmetry is U1, although this intuition applies more generally. But if you imagine the symmetry is U1, then the subsystem symmetry implies that there's a, you know, kind of net electric charge that's conserved on each line. And you can see right away that forbids any single particle hopping processes, right? Because if I moved a charge from this line here to this line here, I would be decreasing the charge of this line by one and increasing the charge of this line by one, okay? So we have charge conservation on each line, and this means that individual charges are necessarily immobile in these models, which also, by the way, means that we are necessarily talking about strongly interacting systems because, you know, for free fermions, these hopping terms are all we have. What is mobile? Well, certainly I can take a dipole, right? So a positive charge here and a negative charge here, and I can move it perpendicular to its dipole moment, okay? So this operation here, because I'm taking a net charge of zero off this line, this is okay, moving net charge zero from here to over here. And at the same time, these guys stay on the same line. And so the charge on the horizontal lines is conserved as well, okay? So charges are confined, dipoles are mobile, but dipoles have this kind of restricted mobility. And again, that just comes from the existence of subsystem symmetry. Now, at this point, you may be thinking to yourself, that's a pretty bizarre symmetry. Why on earth would you want to even think of such a thing? So the first reason and the first context in which people really thought seriously about subsystem symmetries was in making a connection to fracton orders. So, I think the first paper about fractons that really, wrote down a model that was simple enough for a lot of people to understand was by Vijay, Ha, and Fu. And what they did was they started with a model with subsystem symmetry, and they showed that if you gauge that symmetry in a certain way, you get a fracton order, which has now become known as the X-cube model, okay? So this is one, reason that you might start thinking about subsystem symmetries. As you'll see, these 2D models actually use Hamiltonians that are related to ones that people like to think about in quantum information theory, so there's some interest there. But from my own perspective, I think that these are interesting in their own right because the sort of structure of phases that you get out is both similar and also qualitatively different from what we can obtain just by thinking about sort of lower dimensional systems. And also, as I'll get to, I think understanding these subsystem symmetries does shed some light on higher order topological insulators, and in particular, how to understand interacting theories of those. Okay. Are there any questions at this point? We're good. Okay.
Hi, Fiona. I actually have a question for you. So if you try to describe this in any kind of field theory, does your subsystem mean that subsystem symmetry mean that you break some geometric symmetries like rotation symmetry or something?
Yes, right. Yeah. So this is So this is an important point. So the field theories are the field theories that naturally connect to subsystem symmetry are not theories of rank one gauge fields. They're theories of these like rank two, usually symmetric tensor gauge fields of some type. And because, essentially, my understanding of this is that essentially because those gauge fields, they're not in the vector representation of the symmetry, they're in some tensor representation of the symmetry. And then what you find is, you write down some kind of lattice model, and that, these tensor representations are not like, they know a lot more about the symmetry of the lattice that you're working on. And so if you work on the cubic lattice, you will get sort of tensor representations of your cubic point group symmetry. So that's sort of maybe a technical statement, but if I picked a different lattice structure that didn't have cubic symmetry, I would be forced to pick a different set of subsystems, basically, right? I need some kind of lattice planes for my subsystem symmetry to act on. So these are very much more intimately connected to the lattice than.
But does it mean that there's no, isotropic field theory that would describe these?
If by isotropic you mean like invariant under, say, SO3 rotations in general?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. In general, yes. Yeah, okay. We're talking about. Yeah, you have to pick your lattice, and then your theory is invariant under the symmetries of that lattice, or typically it can be, but not under the full SO3 rotation group, right. Which means that the continuum theories are a little weird. Yeah, or different. I should say. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perfect. Great. Anyone else before I move on? Okay, cool. So let me start by saying the following thing. So, let's sort of, you might say, well, okay, I've drawn a part of a system and I'm imagining that this is on some kind of big cylinder, okay? And now I'm looking at a boundary. And all I see is that I have a bunch of, I have a symmetry that can act separately along each of these lines, right? And I'm going to get you know, some kind of, at the end of each line, I could get some kind of projective representation that lives at the boundary. So this is, you know, one example of what I might call a subsystem SVT. And you might say to yourself, this doesn't look very interesting to me because, you know, isn't everything that I'm going to get just going to be expressible as some kind of stack of one-dimensional, you know, SPTs, right? And the answer turns out to be no. And this is, you know, what I think is interesting about these models. And one easy way to see that is you can actually just count the number of phases that you can get by stacking one-dimensional things up and along some cylinder, one-dimensional things with, you know, unit cells of, you know, of your sort of choice in this direction, but that obviously are not on the scale of the system size. And you can compare that with, you know, sort of all possibilities that you might be able to get just by thinking of a symmetry group G. And you can see that in some case, particularly if you think about discrete groups like Z2 cross Z2, there's just more stuff in the set of all possibilities. There's some stuff, some projective representations of these boundaries, okay, that you can't realize with stacks. And so that kind of hints that there might be something you can protect with subsystem symmetry that's actually different from these kind of stacks of lower dimensional things. And indeed, that's the case. And so what I'd like to do is just kind of walk you guys through an example that shows us why this is the case and tell you a little bit about how it works, and then maybe make a few general statements in a couple of slides. And so the example is what we call the two-dimensional cluster state. So again, this is, you know, something that people also in the quantum information community also like to think about. So the Hamiltonian is as follows. So I've drawn a square lattice here, and I've broken it up into red sites and blue sites, okay? And at a technical level, and on each site, I'm gonna have a spin a half, okay? So a Z2 degree of freedom. And I'm going to think of my symmetry as being Z2 cross Z2. Okay. So like a, you know, a kind of Z2 associated with lines in the red sublattice and a Z2 associated with lines in the blue sublattice. Okay. So the Hamiltonian that I'd like to write down is of the following form. So on, I'm going to have one term that has a sigma X on a blue site here. Okay. And then has a product of sigma Z's around the four surrounding red sites and this square, again, of this sort of red sublattice. And then the second term is just, you know, the same with red and blue flipped. So I've got a sigma X acting on this red site in the middle and then sigma Z is around this square here, okay? And you can check that I can, that this Hamiltonian commutes with the operator that applies sigma X individually to any of these lines in the blue sublattice or the red sublattice, okay, in this direction or this direction here. So it has this subsystem symmetry, okay, in the bulk. Now, in order to preserve this subsystem symmetry, note that I have to be a little bit careful about what I put on the boundary. So, you know, an obvious thing that you might want to write at the boundary is kind of just like, if you like, 3/4 of this Plaquette term, right? So I want to put a sigma X operator here, but to have it sort of commute with these guys in the bulk, I'd have to put in these sigma Z's around here. But if I do this, you know, now, for example, this sigma Z operator here is not going to commute with this line of sigma X's sort of coming in here, okay? And so what you might, right, so these boundary terms in particular that I've tried to write down here are incompatible with the subsystem symmetry. And so rather than try and do an exhaustive search of anything we could write down, one way to think about this is let's just leave these terms out, okay? So there's no sigma X term that acts on any of these sites at the boundary and ask what that gives us, okay? And what that gives us is an effective spin 1/2 per site along the boundary. So if you like a kind of 2 spin 1/2 per unit cell along the edge. And the way to see that is, so first of all, there's no sigma X operator that touches this site at all. So I can define a kind of Pauli Z operator on the edge, which is just the sigma Z acting on this blue spin here. But there's also a Pauli X operator that commutes with all terms in the Hamiltonian, which has a sigma X on here, and then a sigma Z over here, okay, on this guy here. And so this gives me, so for each of these sites associated with the edge, so each sort of, I've sort of circle these red spins to say the polys are not just on the site, but rather extend one side into the bulk. I have a spin a half degree of freedom. It has these two poly operators, and these polys actually commute with all terms in the bulk Hamiltonian. Okay.
Sorry, may I ask you?
Yeah.
On the previous slide, was it really this both sigma x products of sigma x, or maybe for one line sigma x and for one sigma z?
No. So remember that. So both of these terms have sigma x acting on the middle site, and then z. So the important thing is that. So I need to have like an even number of. Sigma x is like on each of these. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So yeah, the sigma x in the middle is fine. It obviously commutes with all of these guys, but I have to have lines of x's so that I always hit. Yeah, this is an important point. These lines always hit an even number of z operators in the sublattice in question for all terms in bulk. Okay, cool. Right, so I have these two guys, two poly operators per site on the edge that come in with the Hamiltonian. Okay. And so that gives me some, you know, free spin a half degree of freedom per unit cell on the boundary. Okay. And so not only do I have these poly operators, but you can convince yourself that if you look at the way that these subsystem symmetries act, okay, on these boundary sites, that in fact, when the bulk is in the ground state, the action of these subsystem symmetries is exactly given by these polys on the boundary. And in fact, you'll find that, you know, one of the subsystems is given by pi z. So one of the subsystems acting on this red circle is given by pi z, and the other one is going to be given by pi x. Okay. The action of that symmetry. Okay. And so that tells you that these boundary states, each of these guys, transforms projectively under these bulk subsystem symmetries, right? And so because it's projective, well, that was our way of diagnosing some kind of anomaly. And so you conclude that, well, it's a good thing you didn't try to do an exhaustive search for boundary terms, because we conclude that these guys can't actually be gapped out without breaking the subsystem symmetry. Okay. And now you can come back and ask, you know, so what is it that's different about this kind of boundary than something that I might have gotten just by sort of stacking decoupled one-dimensional systems? And what you'll notice is, you know, basically because these, if you sort of look at the way that these symmetries act, okay, you know, up here, one of them is going to act. So these two subsystem symmetry generators here, you know, sort of act on two sites, each of them. And if you sort of look at the details, what you find is that you get a sort of chain of things that don't commute. So, you know, there's a generator here, this generator here actually does not commute with this generator here, does not commute with this generator that ends here, and so on. And so you get sort of a chain of stuff that doesn't commute all the way up the edge. And this is qualitatively what's different about the boundary of the 2D cluster state relative to something that's stacked 1D systems. Because if I'm talking about a stack of 1D systems, you know, even if the stack involves sort of multiple rows, at some point I'm going to have a cut, right? Where you know, I start my new 1D system and they're not going to talk to each other. And so this kind of chaining is what distinguishes these from what we could get by stacking in weak subsystem SPTs. And I should say that this notion of sort of strong versus weak was formalized in a paper by Trithep Devakul and Dominic Williamson and Yuzhi Yu, where they have a kind of general group cohomology picture of, you know, what is the invariant associated with these strong phases and so on. Okay. Okay, very good. And so we can see that when we look at subsystems, that there is something more. So there really is something two-dimensional about some of these strong subsystem symmetry protected phases. Now, this ability to make these sort of two-dimensional chained projective representations along the edge is a little bit specific to certain symmetry groups. So you can do it with Zn cross Zn, okay? But but many groups, including continuous groups like U1 that don't have sort of discrete torsion in their group homology, you simply don't get more phases than there are phases that you could realize with a stack along the edge. And so you might say, well, those guys, probably the subsystem symmetry is not that interesting, and we can't make anything too special out of them. And so I want to say that even that is not quite true, for the following reason. So even when there's nothing very interesting along the edge of these systems, you can get some interesting stuff at the corners. And so here's a simple model to convince you that you can do that. So let's suppose that it's a kind of funny, if you will, two-dimensional AKLT like Hamiltonian. Okay, so let's imagine that I have a kind of spin two Hilbert space at each site. Okay. And then I'm going to kind of break that spin two into four spins a half, and I'm going to project these spins a half around a plaquette into singlets. Okay. And now let me say that when I do this, I'm actually going to. So when I say spin two, I'm actually just going to talk about having four spin a halves. Okay, I'm not going to apply the projector. But I'm going to keep a sort of U1 spin rotation symmetry rather than the full spin rotation symmetry, okay, in this picture. So I do this in the bulk, and in the bulk, all of these spins are participating in one of these singlets, and so the bulk is gapped, obviously. And when I come to the boundary, so at each site on the boundary, I have a pair of spins one half, so I have a spin one left over. And so spin one is not not projective, certainly not projective under U1, but also not projective under time reversal, which is the other, sorry, I should have emphasized this. The symmetry that I'm keeping is U1, so spin rotation above the z-axis and a global time reversal transformation. And these guys are not projective under time reversal. So we can put a gapped boundary. I have a couple of choices, but let me choose, for the sake of drawing a picture, since we talked about it already, let me choose a sort of Haldane chain. Okay, so I'm going to pair these spin a halves up into singlets. But you observe when I do this that at each corner, I do have a spin one half left over. Okay, so this, if you will, is a different type of subsystem SPT, where the subsystem symmetry. So so I should say that the system symmetry, sort of guarantees that this spin a half is stuck here. Okay, so certainly I can't move, this guy is charged under the U1, I can't move it off and kind of combine it with this guy and get rid of this projective representation, this T squared is minus one representation at each corner. Okay, and so this is, I think of these as a sort of different category of subsystem SPT phases, where the boundary itself is not that interesting, but I get something at the corners here. And what's particularly appealing about this description is that these kind of corner states are exactly the kind of states that you get when you think about higher order band insulators, okay? And so let me just briefly give you the 2-minute description of what this paper by Ben Alcazar and Bernovic, I think it's Hughes and Bernovic, says, which is that if I have a system where the quadrupole moment, is quantized, I can write down an additional topological invariant, okay? And they point out that in order for the quadrupole moment to be quantized, or, just kind of well-defined independent position, a necessary condition is that the system had better have zero polarization, zero dipole moment. And so this, you can sort of think of these higher order topological insulators as systems where, in the filled band, there's some kind of like dipole conservation type thing that emerges, okay? And their observation was that these quantized quadrupole moments can lead to gapless corner modes. If you sort of look at a 2D square, or there are higher dimensional analogs with both corner modes on the cube and also these kind of gapless modes along the hinges between the faces of the cube. And I should say that these require some kind of crystal symmetry, such as reflection of rotation, to stabilize them very, very generally. Okay. And so the interesting observation is that this new kind of sort of topological inflator that came out of band theory has the same phenomenology as this second class of subsystem SPT phase. Indeed, if you can show that if you actually break the subsystem symmetry here. So the role of the subsystem symmetry, again, is basically to pin these spin a half degrees of freedom to the corners of our lattice. And if I break subsystem symmetry, but I preserve an appropriate lattice symmetry, such as the kind of reflections through these two diagonal planes, I can, similarly, I can keep the corner modes, okay? So subsystem symmetry, although it we wrote down a Hamiltonian with subsystem symmetry, we actually got a phase that's robust to breaking it in this particular case. And intuitively, I think of the relationship between the subsystem symmetric phases and the higher order topological insulators as emerging from the fact that, you know, subsystem symmetry is a kind of strong form of dipole conservation, right? So it does more than guarantee that the dipole moment is conserved. It actually means dipoles can only move, you know, perpendicular to the dipole moment. But you know, nevertheless, somehow there's a relationship between these two based on the fact that we have these conserved dipole moments. And a final comment on this is that, you know, you can sort of go back and look at the first kind of subsystem SPT that I told you about with these cluster states, and you can you can ask what happens if I break the subsystem symmetry in that case, and obviously these gapless, you know, this spin a half per unit cell along the edge can now be gapped out because the subsystem symmetry was the thing that was sort of preventing us from having pairwise interactions between those guys. However, you can see that in some cases, when you gap out those edges, if you preserve lattice symmetries, there again, if you go from subsystem symmetry to a global symmetry, there again, you get protected gapless corner modes, which sort of naturally lead you to interacting models of higher order topological insulators. Okay, so it's a kind of interesting connection between these two classes of ideas. I should probably take a minute here to ask if there's questions about this before I go and tell you a few things about three dimensions. No? Okay. Sounds good. So, right. Okay. So in the last sort of 5-10 minutes, I would like to say a few words about you know, going up to three dimensions. And so I'm going to talk about planar subsystems in 3D systems specifically. And in order to set the context for that, we need to, first of all, do a small digression into just two-dimensional systems and two-dimensional SPTs. And so there's a very nice way to think about two-dimensional SPT phases due to Levin and Gu. And so they wrote a nice paper in 2012 where they looked at just two-dimensional models with Ising symmetry. And one way to think about two-dimensional models with Ising symmetry, obviously, is in terms of the spin. So the red arrow here represents the Ising spin, which can be either up or down. But another nice way to think about these models is in terms of domain walls. And so what is done in this picture is there's a spin configuration, right? But in between, so on every sort of edge, if you will, of the dual lattice that separates a spin down from a spin up, there's a green line, okay? And so this gives me what's usually called a domain wall representation of the configuration of my paramagnetic system, okay? And so the key observation in this paper by Levin and Gu is that there's actually two different sort of consistent types of Ising paramagnet that differ in a way that, you know, only becomes really obvious when you look at these domain wall configurations, which is to say, so there's one, the familiar one, okay, the familiar Ising model. If you just wrote down, for example, that my Hamiltonian just acts with sigma x on all of these spins, okay, and I draw my, and the domain walls care about spins with opposite orientations along the z-axis, then I get what I'm going to call an untwisted 2D Ising model, which is just a superposition of all possible, you know, kind of domain wall configurations on my 2D lattice. It's kind of a loop soup, if you will. But there's another thing that I could do, okay, which is consistent, which is that you can have a, you can have the same sort of superposition over all possible domain wall configurations. You can add a minus sign anytime the number of loops is odd, okay? So you get a sort of domain wall loop soup with a different sign structure. And this one I'm gonna call twisted. And the reason for the names twisted and untwisted, for those of you who are familiar with Dijkgraaf-Witten theory, is that this one corresponds to the untwisted Z2 Dijkgraaf-Witten theory, and this one corresponds to the twisted Z2 Dijkgraaf-Witten theory. Okay. And so you might ask, well, what is the consequence of these extra minus signs? And so what you can show, basically by thinking about what would happen if you gauged the Ising symmetry in these two systems, is you can show the following thing. That, so you can imagine, so if I gauge the Ising symmetry, I'm allowed to kind of create a little open domain wall in the bulk and bring it to the boundary, okay? And if this boundary is gapped and compatible with symmetry, okay, then once this domain wall comes to the boundary and it ends, it just, you know, there might be some local excitation here, but basically there's no kind of long range knowledge anywhere in the system, right? Because the bulk doesn't, these domain walls are fluctuating. The bulk can't have a local memory of this path that these guys took to get to the boundary. And also, you know, everything's short range correlated on the boundary, so B can't know anything about A. So that's a thought experiment. And now you can imagine doing this with sort of two pairs of these guys. So I sort of create a little open domain wall in the bulk and I bring it to the boundary at locations A and B and I annihilate it, okay? And then I do the same thing at another location C and D, okay? And what you observe by thinking again about these models where the symmetry has been gauged is that if you do this in the untwisted theory, you just get a plus one, okay? So same thing you would get if you sort of had these, you know, domain walls A and C and B and D, okay? So in other words, same sign for no matter how you connect these guys up in the bulk. But if you do this for the twisted model, then basically you're gonna get an extra sign, okay? When you connect these things up this way versus, you know, if they were connected up in this way here, okay? And they argue that, you know, again, the bulk should not have any memory of you know, or sort of any knowledge of where these domain walls are sitting. And so if the boundary also is completely short range correlated and has no way to know kind of where these guys are, then you arrive at a contradiction. The symmetry must have been broken, okay? And so this is what is called the braiding statistics argument for why, so their conclusion is that this boundary must be gapless, okay? There must be some long range correlations on the boundary. And this is known as the braiding statistics argument for why the edge is gapless. Very good. Okay. So with this, so let's take this braiding statistics argument and ask how we could apply it to systems with planar subsystem symmetry in three dimensions. So let me just briefly, and I can see I should wrap up in a couple minutes, but I don't think this will take very long. So just briefly, you know, write down the simplest Hamiltonian that you could, which has planar subsystem symmetry in three dimensions. And this one is the one that Vijay Han Fu used in their paper about the X cube model. So the idea is I could have a Hamiltonian, maybe I have a sigma X acting on each site. And then instead of the usual Ising interaction, which would be sigma Z, right, pairwise, my Ising interaction is going to be between four spins on the same plaquette, okay? And when I have this sort of quartic interaction between spins, I could put this on the cubic lattice, right? And I can see that the product of sigma X is separately conserved along any plane, any plane in any of the three sets of cubic lattice planes in the cubic lattice. Okay. So now, you know, our picture of how to twist. So we'd like to know how to twist this model. And our picture of how to twist came from thinking about a domain wall picture. And in these subsystem symmetric systems, the domain wall is not the appropriate picture. The appropriate picture is rather what we call domain frame or cage net, they're sometimes called. And so the idea is this. So imagine that I have, you know, one spin on this red site pointing down and all of the other spins on my cube point up, right? And so where's the domain wall, which is to say, where are the violations of this kind of Ising coupling term here? And I'm gonna draw a line through each plaquette that's violated, right? And so what I get are basically lines that can sort of meet at junctions inside the cube like this. Okay. And now, so this is what we call the kind of domain frame picture. And now we'd like to sort of twist it. I'm not going to go through the details. They're a little bit involved. But it turns out to twist it, you want to work on a more complicated lattice whose dual lattice is here. So the dual lattice, again, is where these domain frames live. But suffice it to say that there is a way to sort of modify this Plaquette-Ising model and twist it such that, again, you get sort of superpositions of these cage nets with certain relative minus signs between different configurations, okay? And just like in this two-dimensional picture, you can show that this twisting implies a certain kind of statistical interactions between these sort of domain frames when you end them on the boundary. So here you should think of the purple dots as sitting on the boundary of my 3D system, okay? And the red and blue represent two sort of domain frame configurations that I've brought to the boundary. And what you can see is that if it happens that the red and the blue kind of intersect, which only happens in this case when they live in the same plane, then I'm gonna get this extra minus sign, okay? And then the argument is exactly the same in two dimensions that, you know, if this was a kind of gapped boundary that had no memory of, you know, of exactly how I brought these things to the boundary, that would be a contradiction if this sign is not trivial. Okay. And so there's a kind of analog of the braiding statistics argument. So this twisting of the Z2 model is kind of the simplest thing that you should write down. I should say that unlike the cluster state, this one, you can define a notion of kind of strong and weak also for these 3D systems. The cluster state actually gives you a boundary. You can kind of see this. These guys have non-trivial braiding only in the same plane, okay? This one gives you a boundary theory that is just a stack of sort of two-dimensional systems. But there are sort of a couple of different variants of this that actually give you sort of strong SSBTs, even with these planar subsystem symmetries that I don't have time to go into today. And so let me just sort of summarize what I think are the key maybe take-home points. So I started by just reminding you of what we know about interacting symmetry-protected phases and how we think about those in terms of anomalous boundaries. And one comment is, you know, so in 1D and 2D, the anomaly at the boundary ensures that the boundary is gapless. In 3D, and I personally, can't think in higher than three dimensions, so I don't have anything to say about, you know, sort of 3D subsystems in 4D bulks, but we do know that in three dimensions, global symmetries protect a much richer set of boundary states, which include states with sort of topological orders where the symmetry acts in an anomalous way. And so that's kind of an interesting thought if one tried to extend this to higher dimensions. So we took this kind of picture of symmetry protected phases, and we now turned our symmetries in D dimensions to subsystem symmetries of D dimensional sort of subsystems in some D plus one dimensional bulk, okay? And we saw that there's a very similar picture that emerges of when the boundaries are protected, but that we can get stuff that is, you know, nevertheless qualitatively different than what we could get by sort of just stacking lower dimensional systems. And finally, let me end by sort of saying I think there remain, particularly when we think about, three-dimensional systems and planar subsystem symmetries, I think there remain a number of interesting open questions, for example, about writing down chiral theories and whether there are sort of, you know, what we would call in the 2D context, gravitational anomalies, right, or kind of theories with a notion of chiral central charge that emerge in the context of subsystem symmetry. So let me stop there, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you for a great talk, Fiona. So any questions?
Yes, yeah, Alex.
Alex, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. Very good talk. Can you reiterate once again, how is it all related to anomalies in field theories, which we sort of all...
Yeah, very good. So I should say in the context of, you know, topological band insulators, let me lump integer quantum Hall in with this. Okay, we know of two kinds of things. So there's what we call anomaly inflow, which is where, you know, you write down some action in the bulk and it's not gauge invariant, right? I mean, it's gauge invariant up to a boundary term. And then you have to sort of add some extra, you know, there has to be some fields on the boundary to kind of cancel that anomaly. And then also, I mean, if you actually think about like 3D TIs, for example, these are these funny discrete anomalies that only appear under large gauge transformations. I would say that, you know, one picture, so there is an anomaly inflow type picture of these, of the subsystem SPTs, you know, at least things like the cluster state, and also these sort of 3+1D ones with planar subsystem symmetry. Is that answering your question, or am I going off?
I wonder if it possible to articulate, and if it was articulated in any publication, how do you connect it to field theories anomalies?
In this case, no, I don't think. We have some comments in our paper about, you know, systems with like 2D. I didn't put in any archive references, but we have a paper, you know, that talks about these 2D planar symmetries and 3D systems, and you know, we made an attempt to write down a field theory there, but I certainly think that more remains to be understood about that field theory. You know, kind of like Chern-Simons like field theory, but there's some peculiarities with that field theory, which we can discuss. We could discuss at length, but maybe let me come back to that if there's time later.
All right, thanks.
So Nat, please go ahead.
I had a question about your U1 model. I was wondering if you broke the symmetry down to Z2. Does the corner mode survive?
Does which? The corner mode.
Do the corner mode survive? I was just thinking, how does it compare to the 2D cluster state?
Right. So I have to preface this by saying I haven't like thought about the details of that. My expectation is that it would, that the corner mode would survive. And again, this is because like intuitively, you know, once you just have this spin, you know, this kind of free spin a half on each corner, the role of subsystem symmetry is just to prevent it from moving. And so as long as you preserve a subgroup, and the projectiveness is with respect to time reversal, right? So my expectation is that as long as you preserve a subgroup of U1, which, you know, under which this guy is charged, you should be fine. But again, let me preface that by saying I haven't thought about this carefully, so I could be missing something.
Thank you. But you made a comment about the cluster state when you were talking about this U1, stuff.
Yeah, good. Okay, so right. So I should say that in the U1 example, the time reversal is important, okay? Because the projectiveness is under the global time reversal, okay? Now the cluster state, you only need Z2 cross Z2. And there you can ask what happens if, you know, what can I add to the edge if I just throw away subsystem symmetry, okay, but I preserve a global Z2 cross Z2. And there you can convince yourself that, you know, if you draw your edge in such a way that it preserves certain kinds of lattice symmetries, okay, so you have to like get the right cut on the edge that has certain kinds of reflection planes, that you're left with something at the corner there as well. Is that what you were asking?
Yes. So in that case, you need point group as well.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's right. And yeah, I should say anytime you throw out subsystem symmetry, you're going to need point group symmetries. And, you know, again, like basically their role is to make sure that these guys can't like, you know, wander off the corners and meet in the middle and just annihilate.
Thank you.
At an intuitive level, yeah.
Any more questions? Well, let me ask one question. So if you take an ordinary, 3D time reversal invariant topological insulator, then yes, you can gap the edges at the expense of introducing some topological order. So is there a similar thing for higher order topological insulators?
Okay, so let me make sure, so for higher order topological insulators, if you're thinking in terms of topological band insulators, a picture that you might have in your head is the following. So I start with my 3D TI, and then I'm just gonna break time reversal in such a way that the mass changes sign, between this edge and this edge. This is like a crude kind of model of, basically reflection is not a symmetry, but like reflection combined with time reversal is a symmetry. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that you would have. And so what lives, at the hinge between these two edges is this nu equals one mode, right? And the observation, comes exactly from the statement about the surface of the 3D TI, right? Which is that, the domain wall, what does it mean? Sigma XY is a half. Well, one thing that it does mean is if I take a domain wall between time reversal breaking with one sign and time reversal breaking with another sign, I get a nu equals one, right? And I couldn't do that with 2D systems that have, that have this kind of same property under reflection. Because for a 2D system, it would have to be like nu equals one and nu equals zero, right? So I think that's the way that I think about these. Now, I think if you take these anomalous topologically ordered gap boundaries that you should be able to, it's a good question. My expectation is that you should be able to put them onto the cube without having anything at the hinges, but I actually don't know for sure. I haven't thought about that very carefully.
Okay, thank you. So any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Fiona again for a great talk. I personally learned a lot. So we hope to see all of you again in a couple of weeks. So next week, there is no talk, but in 2 weeks, on April 19th, we will have a seminar again. So see you.
All right.